The Skeptic Society and John Wagner Recording Studios are proud to present the audio recording of Michael Shermer's book, The Mind of the Market. This audiobook is abridged and was edited by Michael Shermer. Dr. Michael Shermer is the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, a monthly columnist for Scientific American, the host of Skeptic's Distinguished Science Lecture Series at Caltech, and adjunct professor of Claremont Graduate University. Dr. Shermer received his BA in psychology from Pepperdine University, MA in experimental psychology from California State University, Fullerton, and his PhD in the history of science from Claremont Graduate University. He is the author of many best-selling books, including The Mind of the Market, Why Darwin Matters, The Science of Good and Evil, The Borderlands of Science, How We Believe, and Why People Believe Weird Things, all available as audiobooks. John Wagner Recording Studios is an award-winning producer of audiobooks, music albums, and documentary film scores. Now, please enjoy this recording of The Mind of the Market.
The Mind of the Market: Compassionate Apes, Competitive Humans, and Other Tales from Evolutionary Economics, by Michael Shermer, read by the author. Published by Times Books, Henry Holt & Company, New York, copyright 2008, by Michael Shermer. Dedication to J. Stuart Snelson, Apere Terram Gentibus, to open the world to all people. Chapter 1, The Great Leap Forward. Living along the Orinoco River that borders Brazil and Venezuela are the Yanomamo people, hunter-gatherers whose average annual income has been estimated at the equivalent of about $100 per person per year. If you walk into a Yanomamo village and count up the stone tools and baskets, arrow points, arrow shafts, bows, cotton yarn, cotton and vine hammocks, clay pots, assorted other tools, various medicinal remedies, hats, food products, articles of clothing, and the like, you'd end up with a figure of around 300. Before 10,000 years ago, this was the approximate material wealth of every village on the planet. If our species is about 100,000 years old, then 90% of our history has been spent in this state of relative economic simplicity. Living along the Hudson River that borders New York and New Jersey are the Manhattan people, consumer traders whose average annual income has been estimated at $40,000 per person per year. If you walk into the Manhattan Village and count up all the different products available at retail stores and restaurants, factory outlets and superstores, you would end up with a figure of around $10 billion. This is a mind-boggling comparison, first made by the economist Eric Beinhacker in his comprehensive study, The Origin of Wealth. Something happened over the last 10,000 years to increase the average annual income of hunter-gatherers by 400 times. As remarkable as this jump in income is, it pales in comparison to the differences between hunter-gatherers and consumer traders in terms of product count, which in modern economies is measured in stock-keeping units, or SKUs, a retail measure of the number of types of products available in a store. By one estimate, for example, 700 new products are introduced into the market every day, a quarter of a million a year. In 2005, there were 26,800 new food and household products alone, including 187 new breakfast cereals, 303 new women's fragrances, and 115 new deodorants. Between the Yanomamo's 300 SKUs and the Manhattan's 10 billion SKUs is a difference of 33 million times. This difference of 400 times in income and 33 million times in products almost beggars description. If ever there was a great leap forward, this was it. Comparable to the evolution of bipedalism, the big brain and consciousness, equivalent to the invention of fire, the printing press, and the internet, and on par with the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, and the digital revolution. And this great leap did not happen gradually. It has been estimated that the $100 per person annual income had risen to only about $150 per person by 1000 BCE, the end of the Bronze Age and the time of King David, and did not exceed $200 per person per annum until after 1750 and the onset of the Industrial Revolution. In other words, it took 97,000 years to go from $100 to $150 per person per year, then another 2,750 years to climb to $200 per person per year, and finally 250 years to ascend to today's level of $6,600 per person per year for the entire world, and as we just saw, an order of magnitude higher still for the wealthiest people in the richest nations. If we compressed that 100,000-year period into just 1 year, then the last 250-year period of relative prosperity would represent less than 1 day out of the year. Or if we condensed 100 millennium into one 24-hour day, our epoch of industrial production and market economies accounts for a mere 3.6 minutes. In other words, the age in which we live and take for granted as normal and the way things have always been, in fact, constitutes a mere 0.25% of the history of humanity. How and why did humans make this great economic leap? We can answer this question by employing the methods and finding of science from a number of related and revolutionary new fields, including complexity theory, evolutionary psychology, evolutionary economics, behavioral economics, neuroeconomics, and virtue economics. We need all of these new fields, along with those from the traditional sciences, brought to bear on this question because it remains one of the greatest unsolved mysteries of our time. For simplicity's sake, I shall lump all of these sciences under the rubric of evolutionary economics, the study of the economy as an evolving, complex adaptive system grounded in a human nature that evolved functional adaptations to survival as a social primate species in the Paleolithic epoch in which we evolved. This is a swanky way of saying that the economy is a very complex system that changed and adapted to circumstances as it evolved out of a much simpler system, that we spent the first 90,000 years of our life as hunter-gatherers living in small bands, and that this environment created a psychology not always well-equipped to understand or live in the modern world. In essence, in trying to explain the Great Leap Forward, I'm addressing three problems about the mind of the market. 1. How the market has a mind of its own. That is, how economies evolved from hunter-gathering to consumer trading. 2. How minds operate in markets. That is, how the human brain evolved to operate in a hunter-gatherer economy but must function in a consumer-trader economy. And 3. How minds and markets are moral. That is, how moral emotions evolve to enable us to cooperate and how this capacity facilitates fair and free trade. This is a really hard problem to solve. Evolution is a complex system that emerges out of the simple actions of organisms just trying to survive and provide for their offspring. Economies are complex systems that emerge out of the simple actions of people just trying to make a living and provide for their children. Thus, when we address 1. How economies evolve from hunter-gathering to consumer trading, 2. How the human brain evolved to operate in a hunter-gatherer economy but must function in a consumer-trader economy, and 3. How moral emotions evolve to enable us to cooperate, and how this capacity enables fair and free trade, we are really studying 1. The behavior of markets and economies, 2. The psychology of people operating in markets and economies, and 3. The moral aspects of markets and economies. Evolution and economics are not just analogous to one another. They're actually two different examples of a larger phenomenon called complex adaptive systems, in which individual elements, parts, organisms, or people interact, process information, and adapt their behavior to changing conditions. These are systems that learn and grow as they evolve from simple to complex, and they're autocatalytic, which means that they contain self-driving feedback loops, as when a PA system develops a feedback loop between speakers and microphone, resulting in an accelerating rise in pitch and volume. Here are some examples of complex adaptive systems and what emerges from them as the built-in autocatalysis leads to their being self-organized. Life is a self-organized emergent property of prebiotic chemicals that came together in a manner that allowed them to be self-sustaining and capable of duplication and reproduction. Complex life is a self-organized emergent property of simple life, as when simple prokaryotic cells coalesced into the more complex eukaryotic cells of which we are made, which contain within them organelles that were once prokaryotic cells, such as mitochondria, which have their own DNA. Multicellular life is a self-organized emergent property of a single-celled life forms, which merge together as a cooperative strategy for more successful survival and reproduction. Immunity is a self-organized emergent property of billions of cells in our immune system working together to combat bacteria and viruses. Consciousness is a self-organized emergent property of billions of neurons firing in complex patterns in the brain. Language is a self-organized emergent property of thousands of words spoken in communication among language users. The law is a self-organized emergent property of thousands of informal mores and restrictions that were once codified over time into formal rules and regulations as societies grew in size and complexity. And the economy is a self-organized emergent property of millions of people pursuing their own self-interest with little awareness of the larger complex system in which they work. Complex adaptive systems appear designed from the top down, but in fact, as they evolve, they construct objects from the bottom up through functional adaptations. What works survives and reproduces into the future designscape of life or culture. From the simplest forms of life up the chain of complexity, we move from simple cells to complex cells to multicellular organisms to colonies to social units to societies to consciousness to language to the law and to economies. In nature, random genetic mutations and the mixing of parental genes and offspring produce variation, and the selection of this genetic variation through the survival of their hosts is what drives evolution. Out of this process of self-organized directional selection emerges complexity and diversity. This is how evolution is a self-organized emergent phenomenon. The evolution of our material economy proceeds in an analogous manner through the production and selection of numerous permutations of countless products. Those 10 billion products in the Manhattan Village represent only those variations that made it to market. So there's already a selection process by the manufacturers themselves as they attempt to correctly predict what the market will prefer. Once these choices are brought to market, there is a cumulative selection for those deemed most useful or desired, with the selection conducted by consumers in the marketplace who vote with their dollars on which will survive. VHS over Betamax, DVDs over VHS, CDs over records, flip phones over brick phones, computers over typewriters, Google over Alta Vista, SUVs over station wagons, paper books over e-books, still, and internet news over network news, soon. Those that are purchased survive and reproduce into the future through repetitive use and remanufacturing. The environment is the design space of evolution. The market is the design space of economics. Just as nature selects the variation best suited to survive in a particular environment, so too do people select the goods and services that are best suited to meet their unique needs and desires in a particular market. Note that in neither evolution nor economics is there a top-down designer to oversee the entire system. In life, no one is selecting organisms for survival or extinction, in the benign sense of animal breeders or in the malignant sense of Nazi doctors. Evolution is unconscious and non-prescient. It cannot look forward to anticipate what changes are going to be needed for survival. The analogy with the economy is not perfect, since some top-down institutional rules and laws are needed to provide a structure within which free and fair trade can occur. But too much top-down interference with the marketplace makes trade neither free nor fair, and when such attempts have been made in the past, they have failed because markets are far too complex, interactive, and autocatalytic. In his 1922 book, Socialism, Ludwig von Mises spelled out the reasons why, most notably the problem of economic calculation in a planned socialist economy. In capitalism, prices are in constant and rapid flux and are determined from below by individuals freely exchanging in the marketplace. In socialism, prices are slow to change and are determined from above by government fiat. Money is a means of exchange, and prices are the information people use to guide their choices. Mises demonstrated that socialist economies depend on capitalist economies to determine what prices should be assigned to goods and services, and they do so cumbersomely and inefficiently. Ultimately, free markets are the only way to find out what buyers are willing to pay and what sellers are willing to accept. For example, studies show that internet airfares change thousands of times an hour, as people search for the best price they can find to reach their destinations. Airlines have sophisticated software programs that adjust the prices according to supply and demand for particular routes, the number of seats available at any given moment, and other variables that go into what has become known as dynamic pricing. Imagine a centralized, bureaucratic airline price committee meeting each morning to work out how much it is going to cost someone to fly, say, from Greensboro, North Carolina to Wichita, Kansas, on each of a dozen different airline carriers, factoring in not only the real-time supply and demand parameters and number of available seats, but also the time of day, type of aircraft, class of travel, cost of aviation fuel, number of frequent flyer miles seats already taken, discount coupons, and dozens of other variables, and doing so for hundreds of thousands of people. It is not an impossible feat to attempt, and planned economies have tried to do it, but like the proverbial bipedal dog, it is exceedingly rare, clumsy, and painfully humorous to watch. Unfortunately for those forced to live in planned economies in the 20th century, the economic disasters that were the inevitable result were neither rare nor humorous. As with living organisms and ecosystems, the economy looks designed, so we naturally infer that a top-down designer, government, is needed in nearly every aspect of the economy. But just as living organisms are designed from the bottom up by natural selection, so too is the economy designed from the bottom up by the invisible hand. Because the first 90,000 years of our history were spent as hunter-gatherers, living in small bands of a few dozen to a few hundred people, we evolved a psychology not always well equipped to reason our way around the modern world. What may seem like irrational behavior today may actually have been rational 100,000 years ago. Without an evolutionary perspective, the assumptions of Homo economicus make no sense. Take economic profit versus psychological fairness as an example. Behavioral economists employ an experimental procedure called the ultimatum game. It goes something like this. You are given $100 to split between yourself and your game partner. Whatever division of the money you propose, if your partner accepts it, you are both richer by that amount. How much should you offer? Why not suggest a 90-10 split? If your game partner is a rational, self-interested money maximizer, as predicted by the standard economic model of Homo economicus, he isn't going to turn down a free $10, is he? Well, he is. Research shows that proposals that deviate much beyond a 70-30 split are usually rejected. Why? Because they aren't fair. Says who? Says the moral emotion of reciprocal altruism, which evolved over the Paleolithic eons to demand fairness on the part of our potential exchange partners. I'll scratch your back if you'll scratch mine. Only works if I know you will respond with something approaching parity. The moral sense of fairness is hardwired into our brains and is an emotion shared by all people and primates tested for it. Thousands of experimental trials with subjects from Western countries have consistently revealed a sense of injustice at lowball offers. Further, we now have a sizable body of data from people in non-Western cultures around the world, including those living close to the way our Paleolithic ancestors lived. And although their responses vary more than those of modern people living in market economies, they still show a strong aversion to unfairness. The deeper evolution of this can be seen in the behavior of our primate cousins. In studies with both chimpanzees and capuchin monkeys, the Emory University primatologist Franz Duval found that when one individual is rewarded for work with a desired food and does not share it with a task partner, the partner refuses to cooperate in the future and expresses displeasure at the injustice. Such results suggest that all primates, including and especially humans, evolved a sense of justice, a moral emotion that signals to the individual that an exchange was fair or unfair. Overwhelming evidence from numerous fields now shows that fairness evolved as a stable strategy for maintaining social harmony in our ancestors' small bands, where cooperation was enforced and became the rule, while freeloading was punished and became the exception. Apparently irrational economic choices today, such as turning down a free $10 with a sense of righteous injustice, were at one time rational when seen through the lens of evolution. Just as it is a myth that evolution is driven solely by selfish genes, and that organisms are exclusively greedy, self-centered, and competitive, It is a myth that the economy is driven exclusively by selfish intentions and that people are excessively greedy, self-centered, and competitive. The fact is, we are both selfish and selfless, cooperative and competitive, peaceful and bellicose, pro-social and antisocial. There exist in both life and economies mutual struggle and mutual aid. In the main, however, the balance in our nature is heavily on the side of good over evil. For every random act of violence that makes the evening news, there are 10,000 non-random acts of kindness that go unrecorded every day. Markets are moral, and modern economies are founded on our virtuous nature. If this were not the case, market capitalism would have imploded long ago. This is not a Pollyannish view of economics, and I am not arguing that businesses operating in a free market vacuum are necessarily always moral. We need checks and balances, and a society based on the rule of law within which markets can be both free and fair. James Madison was right when he wrote in the Federalist Paper, number 51, "If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary." Why do the sciences of complex systems and human nature predict and demonstrate that robust goodness will emerge from chaos and selfishness? As a social primate species, we evolved to display within-group amity and between-group enmity, which leads to a fierce tension between our selfish desire for individual gain or family unity and our social desire for group equality or social unity against outside threats. The first principle of what I call virtue economics is this genetically embedded reflex of reciprocity. When someone gives us something, we feel that we should give something back. For both within-group and between-group interactions, we are greatly shaped by our perceptions of others, especially our perception of what others think of us. That is, we care about our reputation and status. This is why reputation metrics have arisen so quickly on the internet as a self-organized emergent property of trust. Ratings of sellers' reputations on eBay, rankings of the quality of reviewers' assessments of books on Amazon, and the quality and quantity of connections between users as a measure of reputation in social and professional networking sites such as MySpace, Facebook, and LinkedIn are just a few examples of the need for trust in exchanges of any kind. We want to be thought of as fair and honest dealers, yet we are also exceptionally tribal, and group identity is essential to our sense of self. The unfortunate byproduct of such in-group, out-group tribalism is xenophobia. We have a natural aversion to others, and we show a remarkable ability to sort people into in-group, out-group categories on the most minute levels of criteria. Think of such gangs as the Crips and the Bloods, or such ethnic disputes as those between the Hutus and the Tutsis, the Albanians and the Serbs, or the Shiites and the Sunnis. Although we have legislated and educated these ancient tribal rituals out of our culture, their psychological underpinnings are still buried deep in our Paleolithic brains, waiting to be stirred into action. Sometimes they are stirred disastrously in the service of politics and war. Sometimes they are stirred competitively in the service of economics and trade. At the same time, we evolved from bands and tribes to chieftains and states, and communities struggled to find the right balance between freedom and equality by experimenting with different social technologies, leading to a shift from the equal distribution of wealth among bands to the emergence of hierarchical wealth as a token of status and power among tribes. The hunter-gatherer principle of egalitarianism, or at least the pretense of it, disintegrates as bands and tribes coalesce into chiefdoms and states. When wealth becomes a symbol of power, the value of virtue emerges to offset the rival value placed upon personal gain.